So whenever I would talk to the women, they would say, oh, it's great to have water and sanitation. It's great that they're doing infrastructure development. But what about economic opportunity?
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Kashif Foundation is Pakistan's first specialized microfinance institution. It was established in 1996 by Roshane Zafar to provide financial services to low-income women and entrepreneurs, helping them to become economically independent. And today, I am joined by Roshane Zafar, the founder and now the managing director of Kashif Foundation, to talk about what the foundation has accomplished in the last 30 years and maybe what it can achieve in the next 30 as well. Roshane, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's go back at the beginning to 1996, at the time that the foundation started. Describe the obstacles for women who wanted to run businesses or just have access to finance.
So we'll have to backtrack a little bit and go back to my journey, because that's important.
Yes.
That's the highlight that gives you an insight into why I started and why I did what I do. So I'm a development economist by training, and I used to work for the World Bank. And part of my job was to go across Pakistan documenting how social sector development projects were affecting and impacting on women. So whenever I would talk to the women, they would say, oh, it's great to have water and sanitation. It's great that they're doing infrastructure development. But what about economic opportunity?
Mm-hmm.
So wherever I would go, women would talk about the power of money and the lack of economic opportunities, of how if they had the money, they could make the decisions that would improve the lives of their families, because human needs are pretty similar, even if you go down or up the economic scale. So this was a question that kept brimming in my mind. How come there is no solution? How come development is really not addressing the needs of women and economic empowerment? And lo and behold, I met Dr. Yunus, and he gave me that eureka that changed my thinking that there is a model out there. There is a concept which turns around the capital markets on its head, where you are saying, if you are poor and you have no assets, we will take the risk on you because you have the entrepreneurial zeal to change your lives. It connected the dots for me that women have the skills and knowledge ability, but they lack the financial wherewithal to invest in their businesses.
For anyone who's listening who doesn't know Dr. Yunus, can you tell us a little bit more about him and how you came into contact with him?
Okay, so Dr. Muhammad Yunus is the founder, or rather the father, of microfinance in South Asia and the world. He started the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. And recently, as you know, he was the advisor to the interim government. And he transited from the previous government to the current government. So he was part of that as well. He's a highly respected figure, but he's known for his work in poverty alleviation. And I met in a chance meeting in Islamabad at a conference, and we happened to be sitting next to each other. We struck up a conversation, which continued for 3 further years, where I would send him questions and he would send me stories of Grameen women. I left my job, went to Bangladesh, trained under him, and he advised me that the best way forward was for me to go back to Pakistan and to start a small venture for women in my backyard, so to speak. Because the need was there, and that any neighborhood, you have a need for women wanting to start small businesses. And so to answer your question, what were some of the challenges and obstacles? There are at least 4 sets of challenges that continue to permeate a woman who's wanting to start a business in Pakistan at any level. So the first is, of course, her self-esteem. Is she ready herself? Does she feel she has the ability, the knowledge, and the capacity to run a business? The second are her family members, or the social milieu and the social structure that surrounds her. Does she have access to education, skills? Is she taken seriously? Is her social structure supporting her? The third tier is, of course, the gender roles that women have to abide by. And usually they're the ones providing unpaid care. So again, do they have the time to run their business? And the fourth, of course, is now the external challenges. Where am I going to find the money to start the business? Where am I going to find the market? A lot of women have limits on mobility. What are the legalities? It's like peeling an onion. So, and if we add health and if we add social norms, all of those were also the hurdles that women face. So clearing the path for women is a holistic model that you need.
When you set up the foundation, was it really set up to replicate what Grameen does at that time?
Yeah, so it was set up as a Grameen replicator, as it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to take the Grameen methodology.
Yeah.
Now, what Dr. Yunus said to me, it's an interesting comment he made when I was thinking about starting Kashf. He said to me, microfinance is not rocket science. It's going to be the easiest part. All you have to do is take the methodology, the products, the services, and, you know, develop your SOPs and operationalize it. Because we've done it millions of times. So there isn't much innovation or research that you have to do. But your biggest challenge is going to be mindset change, to convince people that this is going to work. And to convince the women entrepreneurs, it's going to work because they're always going to be resistance to change. And there's going to be risk averseness. And there's going to be pushback from the men in the society because this is going to empower women and it's going to change the dynamics. So he was absolutely correct. Even to this day, we continue to wage a war against that endemic mindset, which holds women back. And patriarchy is a very insidious thing. It's not just about men being patriarchal. It's women as well. So it's not just saying that you set a man right and things will work. Unless the women themselves begin to change, things are not going to change. So mindset was really the biggest factor. And that is what then compelled us to change the products and services and the model that we now have at Kashf, because every culture is different.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about that. So as you set up as a Grameen replicator, what did your early experience teach you about the limitations of that in your context?
So, the first limitation was in Bangladesh, it's a very homogeneous communities. When you go from the north to the south, there's very little variation. Pakistan is highly heterogeneous. In fact, there are multiple communities within communities. There's a lot of diversity. So the first thing was that, yes, one standard or cookie cutter approach will work, but you'll have to have variations. For example, when we went to the western part of the country, the community said, oh, yes, we want livelihoods in our homes, but we want a Sharia compliant process.
Right.
So as you began to move outside of, let's say, Lahore, you needed to make a lot of changes to the products and services and to the communication strategies. So that was one clear factor. The other was that microfinance in Bangladesh is highly stratified. It's actually quite patriarchal because it's the men business development officer going and telling the women what to do, how to sit, how to transact businesses. At Kashf, we were very clear that we first started only with women. So we only hired women, loan officers and business development officers. But now, of course, we have a 50-50% gender balance in all our teams. So we had to make sure that the gender equity was reflected within the organization as well, and that this had to be a partnership. Therefore, at Kashf, we use the term Baji. Baji means sister. And it's a respectful term in Urdu. It's the same across Pakistan. Baji is a term that's understood in any local language as well. So we call our client Baji and she calls us Baji or Bhai. Bhai means brother. So, you know, the idea was to develop mutual partnership and not to have this hierarchical way in which to conduct business. So this was more about partnership. That was one. The third thing was that we realized in terms of when we needed to address women's, you know, the social cultural milieu, it was so strongly embedded, as I was telling you, even within the clients that we were working. If you ask them who earns in the household, even though she's contributing the 80% of the income, her likely response is, my husband does it.
Right.
So we realized that there are many, many hurdles when it comes to self-actualization. And that's when we started using theater as a way of changing mindsets. We started doing gender trainings. We started doing reproductive health trainings because all of these things impact on women's decision-making skills. And ultimately, we moved to media. And the idea again was to shake up the thinking of people and to shake up that mindset. So lots of things were similar. The principles of microfinance are the same, but the outward communication and strategies are very different.
I want to ask you about the trajectory of lending during the years that Kashf has been in business. that covers the financial crisis, and a lot of microcredit institutions struggled very much because a lot of borrowers would take multiple loans. It became very difficult to recover those loans. Did you suffer in the same way?
So that's a very, very good question. You know, customer protection is critical. I mean, I can't emphasize that enough. I would blazon it in red highlights because it's just one of the most important things. And we learned it through the hard way. In fact, the entire microfinance industry across the world learned it in a hard way in 2008. So in 2008, the microfinance industry in Pakistan, including Kashf, had a huge delinquency crisis. It was triggered by over-indebtedness, predatory practices, lack of consumer protection, and lack of a credit information bureau, which didn't give us the information of multiple lending. So post-2008, the sector sat down, the regulator sat down, we regulated the sector better. We made more transparent customer protection principles and policies, and we also introduced a credit information bureau. So today, of course, we know exactly what percentage of our borrowers have more than one loan. Currently in the Kashf, we have over 1 million clients, all women. We are the largest microfinance organization targeting women in the country. 60% of our clients are primary borrowers. So we are their only lending partner. 40% have more than one loan. If they have more than two loans, we don't lend to them. So we have an internal policy. And of course, we don't lend to defaulters. Mm-hmm. So I think the transparency comes from better data. And now with technology and, you know, being able to slice and dice information, that has helped us to manage over-indebtedness to some extent. You can minimize it. You can't eradicate it. So we do make sure that every time we transact business with the client, we ask all the right questions to make sure that we are responsibly lending to the client. But yes, I think that 2008 crisis was for us a turning point.
Does this change at what rates you lend? Because you are a business.
We are a not-for-profit, so we're a social business in that sense.
Yeah.
And so as a social enterprise, our commitment is to our clients. We are not answerable to investors. We make sure that any surplus that we generate, it actually goes back to the clients in various forms. We, for example, have our client training programs. They're all for free. We have health clinics. They're all for free. So we keep investing in different aspects or services that will help our client succeed in life. We also offer a huge insurance program. We are one of the largest purveyors of insurance in Pakistan today, of microinsurance. We have credit for life, which everybody does. We have micro health insurance, which is huge. We have almost covered 6 million lives through that. And we have also got livestock insurance. And now we are doing climate insurance as well. As you know, Pakistan on the list of climate vulnerable countries is number 3. And we've had huge floods. And as a microfinance company, we feel very impressed that we must address this. So parameterized insurance is another piece that we are looking at. So the point is that whatever surplus we have, it's used in 3 ways. One is whenever we have the opportunity, we bring down the lending rate to make sure that we pass on the benefits to the client. So last year was a good year for us. Inflation had gone down in Pakistan. The economy was doing better. So we reduced the price. Now, as oil prices have gone up, we are facing difficulty. So we may have to raise up our end user rate a little bit. But the surplus we generate then either goes back like that or goes into a new market development where we add new branches, or it goes into the Microfinance Plus work that we do.
The enthusiasm around microfinance has been tempered a little bit by some of the research results showing the long-term impacts. And of course, there's a famous paper, Banerjee et al. From about 10 years ago now, showing that it had, in their RCT, little impact on the empowerment of women. Do you accept this research? Do you try and work in a different way because of it?
This is my pet peeve with the RCT. When we are talking about empowerment, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
You have to have a long-term view. The RCT was a very short-term view, and we cannot say on the basis of that, you know, throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater because this is what your research showed. So I think the longitudinal impact of empowerment requires a different approach to research. Last year, we worked with the University of Minnesota to look at the longitudinal impact of Kashf Foundation's work. So what they did is, they took 10-year data from us and they tracked clients to see what changes there were on their income, saving, and their decision-making. And we saw statistically significant results. This was a third-party assessment of our data. Mm-hmm. What we saw is that there was a direct correlation between the number of loans you took and business income. There was a direct correlation between savings and the number of loans you were investing in your business. Dr. Yunus had said to me that risk averseness is going to be your biggest challenge when it comes to women investing in their businesses. And what that research showed us, that women, once they've taken one loan and succeeded, and they see their peers also succeeding, they're more likely to take a second loan and enhance their business. And they're going to continue to do that. So if everybody's doing well, then their risk averseness will go down. So again, the mindset change that you see. And then, of course, we also do our own impact assessments. We've just done one where we map empowerment indicators three ways. One is the woman's own self-perception about her decision-making and her empowerment. So in all the impact assessments we've done, 70 to 80% of women say, I feel more empowered now. I have more control and agency over decision-making, whether it's sending my daughters to school or investing on better food or healthcare for the family. And there will always be a well-being impact. See, we also have to talk about empowerment in the context of well-being and social good to the household. Again, RCTs was a very linear way of determining. This well-being is a very horizontal way of looking at things. So has there been intergenerational change? Then we also looked at interspousal relationships. Have those changed? Have fights between the husband and wife incidents been reduced? Mm-hmm. Has domestic violence gone down? Has the husband's labor supply increased, stayed the same, or gone down? Then in our context in Pakistan, the mother-in-law and the in-law's role in the ability of the woman to run a business is very important. We also map that on the empowerment scale. We also look at empowerment through the digital lens. Does the woman own her own phone, mobile phone? Does she have a smartphone? Does she have internet connectivity? So, you know, empowerment is such a broad thing that by just one RCT, you can't just eradicate or negate the impact of microfinance.
So let's talk a little bit more about how you change perceptions, change behavior to achieve that empowerment. You have already mentioned the insurance products that you sell. For a lot of organizations like yours, insurance has been quite a hard sell. It's been very difficult to get people to take it up. What has your experience been?
Again, it's about being client-driven and using your research and your data. So let me go back in time. In 2000, when we were almost like 4 years old, many of our clients came to me and said, look, we are responsible for making payments on our own. We are accountable to pay. But what happens if I die? Who's going to pay on my behalf? So in mm-hmm. Islam, paying your debts before you pass on to the next world is a primary responsibility. That's how the micro life insurance came about. We started with the client, but then she came to us and said, well, my spouse needs to be covered as well. So then we added life insurance, credit for life for both the client and the husband. Now let's move 10 years forward to 2009. Our impact assessment showed that healthcare expenditures and healthcare contingencies were endemically tied to the household's ability to move beyond the poverty line. So we began investigating it and we discovered that, yes, I mean, people have to pay out of pocket. They don't have any insurance. And that's when we went to an insurance company and started working with them to design and pilot. Now, designing was equally difficult, designing the product, convincing the client, because this was a contingency that may not happen. So the probability of using that insurance was an intangible. And yes, there was a tangible that in case it happened, it would be covered. So educating the client was very important. And convincing the insurance companies, so they needed to see the business case for this. Then the third element was getting the private sector hospitals across the country interested in the insurance business because they wanted cash. They didn't want delayed payments. That was quite a challenge on all scales. But over time, now this has become the top of mind. When clients come to us, they say, oh, we are coming to you because we like your health insurance. And then we also had to use trainings and theater and other means of communication to convince people that this was an important piece. And the other challenge that was very difficult was convincing the staff, because the staff was like, you know, if I'm going to tie this to the loan, my client's going to run away. They're not going to come back.
Yes. You have also been involved in lending to schools, which might surprise some people because they might think, well, that's the government's job.
Yes, it is the government's job. I agree with you. But in Pakistan, with almost more than 30 million children out of school, we have a crisis, an education crisis. And as a country and as an individual working in Pakistan, we felt very responsible for meeting that and being creative and to have all hands on the deck approach. So about almost 15 years ago, again, we started doing research and we discovered very interestingly that our clients, the moment they had money, were taking their children out of public schools and putting them in these low-cost private schools.
Right,
that really intrigued us. We wanted to see, was there a quality difference? What was going on? And we discovered, yes, there was a quality difference because the teacher absenteeism in the private schools was nil, while the teacher absenteeism in the public schools was very high. So the mothers were extremely savvy. So we then started doing research on these low-cost private schools and discovered that 70% of them were run by women. So, hey, that made sense to us. You know, it's a social good being managed by entrepreneurially by women. Oh, that was a no-brainer for us. So then we started investing in these schools across the country. We have over 3,000 schools right now that are mostly run by women in local communities, and they're charging around £2.50 as fees per month per child. We also had a requirement in these schools to increase the girls' enrollment. So 50% of the student base in these schools is now girls as a result.
I had an excellent time when I was researching for this, looking up the television dramas that you have been involved with. They bring up gender issues as well, though, don't they? They forefront those. I would imagine that might be controversial. Why did you get involved with them? What's the reaction been?
So, Tim, this was, again, one of those inadvertent things that happened because somebody's sitting up there, you know, pulling the strings and saying, you've got to do this. I'm not from the media background at all. As I said, I'm an economist. I look at numbers. I run an organization that, you know, is looking at economic change. I was at a conference where they were showcasing, it seemed like a very interesting session to go to, on how telenovelas had impacted gender and gender change in Brazil and Mexico. I found that very intriguing and I decided to just attend that session. And in there, they showcased these amazing top-of-class drama serials and soap operas that they had done with the best talent and how popular they had been, and yet they had changed the mindsets. So this was really intriguing to me. At the same time, as I mentioned to you, we use theater in communities to communicate on issues like child marriage, girls' education, women's economic empowerment, health insurance and its benefits. Because this was the best mode to communicate a message rather than just going and telling, we thought seeing is believing. So we've been doing theaters in communities for the past 30 years. And this is also indigenous because South Asia, and in particular Pakistan, has had a strong legacy and heritage of street theater. Before television, that was how people used to find entertainment. We revived that, and it was also a youth initiative because most of the theaters that we run or groups that we have are young people who we train and we give them scripts and then they go and they do these performances across Pakistan in local languages. So there was a precedence, but not of the same scale. I thought, well, this is great because we have millions of stories of women succeeding and we have real life examples of women's lives and their narratives. But these narratives nobody wants to hear and neither are they showcased.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a very close family friend who has been in media and sought her advice when I came back. And she suggested that we go and meet one of the channel owners who's a woman herself and maybe convince her. She got convinced and that's how we did our first show. And that was so successful that it just continued. It took a life of its own. And we've taken up some extremely difficult topics like child sexual abuse, human trafficking. We've done cyber crime, cyber harassment, and we've got lots of accolades. And the most important thing is that it started discussions on these issues.
But have you had pushback as well from people who say you really shouldn't be making dramas about this? You shouldn't be getting involved with this?
There's a monitoring regulatory agency of the government that is called PEMRA, and that looks at censorship. So when we did our second drama on child sexual abuse and we brought this topic out, there was a lot of hue and cry.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sent a legal notice saying that you should not be showing this because this is obscenity. This is propagating obscenity in society because you are showing child abuse and people will get motivated to conduct this crime. It was very warped in their understanding. My father's a lawyer, so he put together the response. And once the response went, we didn't hear back from them. But yes, we have had regulatory concerns and censorship concerns. But you have to do this very sensitively. So we have a great media team. We have a great creative team that looks at these issues to make sure that any topic that we pick up, we do it sensitively and we do it thoughtfully and mindfully.
So many things to talk about, but we can't talk about all of them. But I really do want to mention the gender bond that you launched. What does this aim to achieve?
Again, this goes back to my own experience. This was 2005. And I had been asked to go to the New York Stock Exchange to ring the bell, along with a couple of other women leaders from across the world.
Congratulations.
So in 2005, I was standing there and I'm wondering to myself, when will the day come when we can link women entrepreneurs, micro women entrepreneurs to capital markets? The gender bond is a amalgamation of that thought. Took me a while to convince people. We did do a term finance certificate some years ago, but that wasn't listed. This was the first one we did that was listed. And a company that we worked with for the listing and the entire processing and the getting the roadshows done and getting guarantees was run by a woman also, Infra Zamin. When women get together, things happen. I met her at a conference and we struck up a conference conversation and then we had a cup of coffee and that coffee led to the gender bond. But the purpose of the bond is to link capital markets to women entrepreneurs and make them capital worthy. And that's what we did. And we are going to be doing another one. But we did another very interesting thing, which was a follow-on, which was a gender sukuk, which we did on the Luxembourg market.
Right.
And the idea was then to move from local Pakistani market to the international market, but to do it with a Sharia compliant mode. So we did that also last year.
And the job's not done yet.
Oh, no.
Over the next 30 years, what's your priority now and in the near future?
Yeah, so the first priority now that we are trying to address is climate risk, because that is affecting women a lot, both in terms of their livelihoods, but also in terms of well-being and in terms of their entire life cycle. That's going to be our biggest challenge. Can we climate-proof our products? Can we create resilience in communities and within women-led businesses in communities that are climate vulnerable? Can we design the right insurance products? So that's a big piece of this. Then we're also doing another program. If you look at a triad of economic needs, microfinance deals with the poor in the middle, what we call working poor. When we go below that threshold, you will have the destitute or, you know, people who are either transitioning in and out of poverty. We want to do an ultra poor program, which is going to be another type of project that we haven't done before. We will continue to invest on women's livelihoods and the training part. We're also going to be using AI going forward to help us be more productive and efficient in the credit decisions we take, because with the expanse of the program, you can actually help your frontline officers make better decision making with AI. So that's also going to be another piece of this. And of course, we'll continue to grow and add more numbers as we move forward.
So when you put all this together, it's an unfair question, but I'm sure you get asked it all the time. What would you consider over the last 30 years was your biggest achievement?
I guess the women that we've helped facilitated to run businesses and demonstrated that women matter to the economy. We've demonstrated that an organization that is run for women, by women, with women, can be sustainable and can continue to grow. I think we've also made great headway in being recognized nationally and internationally for women's economic empowerment and for proving through the data that we have that investing in women is good business.
Inspiring. Roshani, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
If you want to find out more about the Foundation's activities, then you can find them on the internet, of course, at kashf.org, spelled K-A-S-H-F.org. We will put lots of links for you in the show notes, of course. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes also at voxdev.org with articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. VoxDev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at VoxDev.